This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. On today's program, we'll chat with one of the most exciting young violinists on the scene, an artist who performs a wide variety of styles and genres that come from her roots and upbringing, Tessa Lark. The award-winning classical violinist studied at the New England Conservatory and the Juilliard School and has been soloist with top orchestras and top festivals and concert venues across the country. She's won prestigious awards, such as the Naumburg, which firmly plant her on the track to being a great classical violinist. But having grown up in Richmond, Kentucky, she also has, since her earliest days on her instrument, used it to play bluegrass and other American roots music, which she still does, and incorporates into her performances, in addition to her performing abilities as an improviser and playing jazz. She's a true 21st century virtuoso. The selections you'll hear by her in the first part of this program came from a recital she gave at the Oberlin Conservatory of Music at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, with Andrew Armstrong as pianist, such as what you're hearing now, the song En Orilla del Mundo, At the Edge of the World, by Cuban composer and songwriter Martin Rojas, as arranged by my guest. She's giving a free concert, again with Andrew Armstrong, at the Baruch Performing Arts Center at Baruch College in Manhattan on Halloween. I'll give you details about that at the close of the program. Baruch Performing Arts Center, one of our broadcast partners here at the Classical Network. I spoke with violinist Tessa Lark by phone a few weeks back. Very good today to be speaking with violinist Tessa Lark, and we're talking with you now because next Wednesday, on Halloween, you'll be performing an early evening concert at Baruch Performing Arts Center at Baruch College in Manhattan. They are one of our broadcast partners. And we'll get to that program, but you're going to be back in New York City. You attended Juilliard. You also attended the New England Conservatory. Many great young violinists have come out of those institutions over the last few decades. Those East Coast institutions, however, are quite a ways from where you grew up. So just kind of a larger question to start with, because you do some things, which we'll get to in the interview, that how do you view yourself as quite a bit the same as some of those really, really great violinists coming out of those illustrious music schools, and how you also try to set up your careers different? How do you view that?
I guess to just put it in one sentence, I've sort of played and performed things that feel natural and sincere to me. So that includes, for instance, other styles of music like bluegrass and jazz. Bluegrass specifically, because I grew up in Richmond, Kentucky, as you were saying, far away from the right. Northeast, but still in the U.S. And my father plays bluegrass banjo, so there's a lot of bluegrass being played in the house. And through that influence, did a lot of summer camps, specifically Mark O'Connor's fiddle camp, where right. I learned lots of different styles of music. So that was part of my musical upbringing. But at the same time, I started my formal training with the Suzuki method for the first 4.5, 5 years. And then I went to a pre-college program in Cincinnati and started studying classical music seriously. So in that way, I have a similar training to a lot of the great, great, great instrumentalists that are coming out of those schools, New England Conservatory and Juilliard. A lot of those people had similar pre-college training that I had, but I also had, you know, the multilingual musical influence as I was growing up. And so it's just a very natural thing that comes to me. It wasn't necessarily a choice. It's just kind of what was going on in my household and how I grew up and what I enjoyed doing.
I think, as we're going to discover here as we speak with you, is that there are so many great instruments. If you just look at the violin, I mean, just people of your kind of age strata. I know two of your friends, and they've been past cadenza guests, Ben Bielman mm-hmm. and Augustin Hedelich.
Yeah.
You know, but some of these great violinists were not exposed to a lot of the music you were growing up. And therefore, you know, they lived lives that were mostly centered in the classical music world. I mean, you did do a lot of things. I mean, you debuted with the Cincinnati Symphony at the age of 16, but go back even further. tell the story how you very precociously brought a mandolin into kindergarten show and tell.
Yeah, I guess the secret's out.
Yeah.
So I played mandolin before I ever played the violin when I was around 4 years old. And the first tune that I ever learned was Boil'em Cabbage Down. And I was so excited about being able to play an instrument that I thought it was a good thing to bring in for show and tell. So I played Boil'em Cabbage Down for all my friends in kindergarten in Kentucky. And then recess started shortly after show and tell, which is 15 minutes long. And I remember just finding a corner in the room and facing the corner and just practicing more Boil'em Cabbage Down during recess. And I think I got in trouble because I just wasn't playing with any of the kids, which is the point of recess, is
right.
to learn how to, you know, share and converse with people. But I was stuck with my mandolin, and I just loved practicing the thing, and I just didn't want to, you know, play with my friends. I wanted to play with the mandolin. So that's always been a thing for me. I just love music. I've always been interested in sort of improving playing instruments. And that was ever since I was 4 years old. And that was a great example of kind of the way I operate that kindergarten show and tell day.
Your parents really need to be credited with sort of saying, hey, she's got some extraordinary musical talent here, right? And sort of getting you on the path, correct? I mean, they really saw what you had going here.
Yeah, they're extremely open-minded, very creative people. My father, by profession, he's retired now, but he was a wildlife biology professor at Eastern Kentucky University. And my mom majored in visual arts and architecture. And my older brother, raised by those very same parents, is an amazing mechanical engineer. So there's a lot of variety in the household, and they just kind of kept their ears and eyes open for whatever was interesting to the two of us, me and my brother. And when I was really little, I was picking up tunes that I was hearing on the radio on this little toy keyboard that I had. And so I think they just noticed me doing that, and they saw that I started adding my left hand with my right hand on the piano and was, you know, harmonizing things. And so they asked me if I wanted to play an instrument, and I said I definitely did. And so that's how it got started. And they were always, always encouraging along the way to just pursue whatever we enjoyed. So even if it wasn't music, they were certain to let me know, you know, they said, we will still love you no matter what you decide to do. So super encouraging parents. Yeah, I owe everything to them.
Yeah. Some formative years things. One of our most popular programs that we air, which we do not produce in-house, is Chris O'Reilly and From the Top. And you were on that twice, right? You were a double timer for that program?
Yeah, at least twice. I think I've been on a few times. I was only on the show once as a pre-college student.
Yeah.
And I think that was in 2003. And then I was on there, I think, two other times as a college student and then coming back as an alum. And I'm really, I love all the people at From the Top, and I stay in close touch with them. And the latest thing that's happened with them is that they made possible a commission that I asked for from another alum, Michael Thurber.
Yeah.
Yeah, I asked him to write me a violin concerto, which I premiered in April, and I'm playing a lot this year. Actually played it three times this month with the Louisville Orchestra, which was a lot of fun. But I asked him to write that piece, and Michael told From the Top about it, and they said, we'll pay for the commission. So
we're still
in touch and doing a lot of great projects with them, but they're a very important part of my life, From the Top is.
Yeah, I mean, we hear all the young musicians each week that Chris has on the show, but we rarely get to talk to one who's really made a career. And actually, I mean, I guess the first time you're on, you know, when he's introducing you and all that stuff, you know, a lot of people hear this program, so you probably got feedback from, you know, family and friends and all that, and that's probably pretty a fun thing to do, is to get that exposure.
Yeah, and I mean, back then especially, it was such a huge deal to be on From the Top and be on national public radio, and it was such a huge thing for my generation. And so all my musical friends, too, you know, they'd say, oh, my gosh, you got to be on From the Top.
Right.
That's so cool. And it was a lot of fun to meet Chris O'Reilly. And the time that I played on From the Top the first time was with my music program that I was taking part in Cincinnati, the Starling Strings program.
Right.
So that was really special, too, to do it as part of that great program.
Once again, from her recital at the Oberlin Conservatory, my guest Tessa Lark with pianist Andrew Armstrong, selections from Béla Bartók's Romanian Folk Dances. Thank you. You mentioned these, and it's interesting. Cadenza's been on the air 13 years, well over 600 programs, and I have very few times have I had repeat guests that you can count them on one hand. But two of them, who've actually been on two or two and a half times, are both great violinists. One's Josh Bell. And the other's Mark O'Connor, and I know Mark very well. And you did attend his, he's talked about his fiddle camps when he's been on Cadenza, and you talked about attending them. And other great violinists, I'm thinking of Rachel Barton Pine and people like that, have been connected with the camps. Maybe just give us a little insight, because what Mark tries to do, just as a little backup, and you can fine tune this, is Mark's teaching not only violin, but other instruments as well. And he's doing it in these camps, but also in his methods, using American roots music to try to trace various techniques like improvisation and things. But attending those camps, what did they do for you?
Yeah, that's all very accurate. And at the time that I attended the camps, they were down in Tennessee. They were a week long. He hadn't yet developed his method, so that wasn't yet involved in the festivals. And how did that influence me? It was so unbelievably inspiring. And I just realized that being a musician is so much more than just being able to quote, you know, orate some notes that are on a page. And so for me personally, I decided that I couldn't call myself a musician unless I learned how to improvise to a certain level. So that was the main influence for me there. And just meeting different people from all walks of life and different styles opened my eyes to the world of music. And also the fact that genres, I don't know, genres have sort of been created to market different types of music and organize them for the consumer, you know, population. But otherwise, genres don't really exist. And that's what I noticed being at Mark O'Connor's Fiddle Campus, all these American-influenced styles of music, and classical music was there too. They all have their roots in similar places and are all influenced by the other styles. And that was a big takeaway for me and the other participants too at his camps.
I guess it was after the camps. I mean, another thing, just to show a little bit of a different artist you are, when you got to New England Conservatory, you went into an improv class, and that kind of sparked at least dabbling in jazz, right?
Yeah. I took a lot of contemporary improv classes, and that was majorly inspirational to me to be able to sort of see what was going on in the other parts of the school. And actually, I studied a little bit at Juilliard, too, and did an artist diploma there just a couple of years ago. And I did the same thing there. I asked if I could collaborate with a jazz department. So they put me in with a Juilliard jazz ensemble, and we played gypsy jazz at Dizzy's after working together a little bit. And as far as I know, I was told that that was one of the first times that a classical major actually collaborated with the jazz department. So that was really fun to sort of get that started at the Juilliard School too. And I think it's a thing that's going to be happening more and more throughout the years. But it was particularly special at NEC that they offered those contemporary improv for non-majors. That was the first class that I took there that was outside of the classical realm.
One more dip into my guest Tessa Lark's recital performed at the Oberlin Conservatory at Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio. Three movements here from the Suite Italienne by Stravinsky, themes from the great 20th century composer's neoclassical ballet Pulcinella, in which he refashions the music of 18th century Italian composer Giovanni Pergolesi. Thank you. I think what our listeners need to know is that the things we've been talking about here the last few minutes, these aren't normal things that a hardcore classical violinist takes time to do, because there's so much you have to learn. I mean, not only for your career, all the concertos and all the repertoire, but it's just, it's pretty intensive, and you've made time to make this part of your career. One thing a little more mainstream that's affected your career, I guess, or part of it, the makeup here, is competitions. You've had a pretty good deal of success. Of course, you won the Naumburg International Competition in New York, which is huge. How have they played in? Because the whole view of how a competition is run and what it really does for someone these days has changed a lot over the last decade. So I'm just curious how you view them. And, you know, would you be the same artist if you hadn't done them, that type of thing? You know?
Yeah, they certainly have changed a lot. I think back in the day, decades ago, one would have more certainly had a certain level of a career if they had won a competition of any national, international standing. But these days, it's not as certain. But the competitions that I did, I made sure that the prize that went with them, if you win, are more real-world sorts of rewards. So, like, getting to perform with different orchestras. And, I mean, money is really nice, of course, but right. That doesn't really get you so many places. And then to the other part of your question, I'm pretty positive that I wouldn't have the career that I do without the competitions that I've done, especially the Naumburg, which was, I was unbelievably lucky to win it, first of all, but also that competition, it so happened that it took place just a month after I graduated with my master's from New England Conservatory. So this was just a few weeks after I'd graduated, and I had no idea what the next few years were going to hold for me. I was not going to go back to school. So I was trying to figure out what in the world I was going to do. But with that prize, I actually had some concerts to sort of start things up. And as you said, it's a really prestigious competition, and so people know about it. And I think just from having it on my resume alone, it was an amazingly helpful thing. And it's actually, the next violin competition is happening next month, I think, in November. So it's another big year for Naumburg. But besides that, with competitions, they really test your stamina and your ability to remain disciplined and just test your work ethic. And I think for that reason, competitions are just incredible. They make you work really hard. The pieces that you learn for a competition, you will know for the rest of your life super well. And you meet all kinds of colleagues that you'll keep running into for the rest of your life. So it's a great connector. And what a lot of teachers say, and what I always say, is that if you win a competition, it's really awesome. And if you don't, it doesn't mean a single thing. So I was always a fan of just kind of pushing myself and getting myself to those competitions. I'm not really a competitive person in terms of competing with others, but very personally competitive with myself. So in that way, I really thrived in that sort of work ethic.
You know, like you said, the money is great if they offer money as prize, but one of the big components that's completely missing from what was there 20 to 30 years ago was competition winners were usually guaranteed some kind of recording contract or recordings with some kind of classical, you know, either major classical label or something like that. And that's completely out the window. I mean, you really do have to look that they make sure they give you performances, guaranteed performances over some kind of range. So you've gone through all this and you've got this career now. How do you balance what you've got going now between doing solo recitals, soloing with a large orchestra, chamber music? I mean, what is the balancing act now?
Oh, man, the balance keeps changing. Sometimes it seems like the balance just sort of naturally finds me. But like I've been sort of hinting at, the music world, the genre walls are slowly disintegrating. And so I'm finding that there's a lot more interest lately in my pursuit of other styles of music.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that that's sort of an avenue that I'm exploring a little more, even with these concertos that I've commissioned, the one I mentioned about Michael Thurber. He used a lot of different styles of music to write that piece, blues and bluegrass and Texas swing style. Country rock is all in there, and that's been getting a lot of plays, I think, for that reason. And Michael Torkey, who's another great composer,
right,
he just finished writing me a concerto called Sky, and I'm premiering that in January, and it's totally bluegrass inspired. So that's just an example of, you know, you're asking about balance, and it seems that, you know, commission projects and playing those concertos with orchestra is sort of taking priority at this point. And then there's this set of a few recitals that I'm doing with Andrew Armstrong, and then the one this week is part of that little tour. So it just sort of look at the calendar for the next year or two and you see what's going on and see how it sticks, where you're going, what you're playing. And I just sort of go from there. And the common denominator between it all is that I just love playing all the different styles. And so whatever I'm doing, I just make sure that the love for music is still there. And then I know I'm on the right track.
From a work written specifically for my guest by American composer Michael Torkey, from his three-movement work Spoon Bread, here's the last movement as played by my guest and the work's dedicatee, Tessa Lark. Thank you. You mentioned two composers' names, and composers, I think, will and are taking notice of artists like yourself that are a little bit broader in their range and interests. Michael Torkey, again, past cadenza guest, but he also wrote you the work Spoonbread, which is a sonata which he said takes in your sensibilities, which is a nice way of saying I like that she can play in other different styles and has the chops to do that. Michael Thurber, you want to talk a little bit about Love Letter?
Yeah, sure. So I met Michael through From the Top at a board meeting. Michael's on the board at From the Top, and I was just there visiting, and I heard a piece of his that he wrote for From the Top a few years ago called Three Musketeers, and it was for four soloists and orchestra. And I heard the broadcast of it, and I absolutely adored the music. So I called him right away and asked him if he'd write this piece, and he said he'd love to. Michael is an amazing specimen of a musician. He's a composer of concert music, but also of pop music and songs, and he writes a lot for theater and for Broadway. He's even acted on Broadway before and written a one-man musical, for instance, is in, you know, book writing processes for other things. He used to play bass on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert as part of Jon Batiste's band. And I think he was the first student at Juilliard to ever be accepted into both the classical and jazz programs separately. So he and I have similar interests in many, many different styles of music. And so I think that's what drew me to ask him to write this piece to begin with. But it's been a lot of fun programming it this year and playing it. And one of my favorite concertos to play because it's absolutely relevant. Wherever you go in America, people recognize these sounds that are in the piece, but it's also a very serious and at times poignantly introspective work too. So it sort of checks all the boxes that you could ask for in modern day music.
And again, written with your musical personality in mind and the range of that, which I suppose should bring us back to the music you heard growing up and the music you played in your kindergarten class on mandolin. And, you know, the roots music that people know as quote-unquote bluegrass, there's a lot of other influences in bluegrass that go under that title. Mm-hmm. Having to play this on the violin, you grew up, I don't know this for a fact, you probably played this music on a violin. I know you did Suzuki before you were sawing away on whatever Suzuki had you playing. But, you know, you've called it Stradgrass because you're playing this now on on instruments. And I don't know if you're still on the
ex-Gingold.
The Gingold violin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But just rationing in your mind, playing this music on an instrument, which, you know, whoever made the instrument and its long history, the instrument I'm talking about, never came to face with this music. So I just, you know, you've had to rationalize that over these years. So
a little bit. I mean, honestly, it didn't take too long to feel okay about it. But yeah, I had the ex-Gingold Stradivarius for about 4 years.
Yeah.
Somebody else is going to be playing it now. I gave it back to the International Violin Competition of Indianapolis. And that's another real-world prize example. They gave me an amazing violin for 4 years to use, which was incredible. But I'm now using a violin on loan to me from the Stradivarius Society. It's an amazing Magini violin made in 1600, so almost 83 years even before that Strad was made. But yeah, so I started playing these fine instruments and didn't change what I was playing on them. So that included bluegrass. And it was just kind of a joke at first to call it Stradgrass and something else entirely. But I have to say these violin, you know, there's no difference between a fiddle and a violin. The preference of sound might differ a little bit between fiddlers and violinists. But I have to say I heard a fiddler play that ex-Gingold Strad, and that fiddler happened to be Michael Cleveland. I just ran into him randomly one day at a music conference, and I asked him if he'd ever played a Strad before, and he said no, and so I let him play it for a few minutes, and he said right away, he's like, oh, this man, this thing really, really likes to drone. And so he started playing some double stops and a lot of really beautiful resonant things on it, and I don't know if it's ever sounded much better than that. So these instruments, I mean, they're totally fit for fiddlers, too. And I hope someday that fiddlers, and they do, actually. Mark O'Connor I don't know what he plays now, but I know for a while he was playing an amazing Guillaume violin, an amazing French maker. It sounds really good on film music, and this Magini is no exception. It's got a really dark temperament to it.
Yeah.
And I think that works super well for bluegrass and Appalachian style music. So yeah, at first I'd always joke, you know, that I felt kind of, it was sacrilegious to play other types of music on the Strad, but honestly, it's I think it's what needs to be done, because that style of music deserves to sound as good as it possibly can. And some of the greatest musicians of all time that are alive today and that have ever lived come from those American roots music styles. So they deserve the best instruments too.
Well, it's interesting that we think of bluegrass and this roots music going back to our early years as a country, you know, mid-19th century, maybe some of these tunes. Yet the violin you're playing it on was created 250 years even before that. So just very interesting perspective. So from this violin concerto is composed by Michael Thurber for my guest Tessa Lark. He and she found some romantic common ground. The work titled Love Letter, a four-movement work, this the finale called Whiskey Woman, about which the composer writes, "This movement is a party, stylistically somewhere between a bluegrass song and a rock song. I was inspired by a memory. I went to visit Tessa at the Marlboro Music Festival, and we went to square dancing night. Everyone had indulged in copious amounts of Maker's Mark whiskey and couldn't follow the dance steps. Refusing to be deterred, we all passionately staggered around, trying our best to follow the steps and making up our own as we went. This is all depicted in the jagged time signature changes and odd rhythms you'll hear. After that night, we found a shirt that read Whiskey Woman and bought it for Tessa. She's worn it ever since. The fourth movement, Whiskey Woman, from Love Letters. Music by Michael Thurber. The soloist, my guest today, Tessa Lark.
Thank you.
the recital you're giving next Wednesday on Halloween at 6:30 at Baruch, you will be playing music that this violin in some fashion was made for. You're playing Beethoven, the Kreutzer Sonata, right? Mm-hmm. And then Stravinsky's Suite Italienne, which is actually based on music a lot closer to when the violin was given birth.
Yeah.
And then people who go and attend this are going to get a taste of what we've been talking about in this interview, and it's your own piece, and you've played this a lot. Talk about you stepping into the role of composer. I think you do borrow a little bit from early, but you can tell, you know, you're a composer, but also takes in this whole what you bring to the table as far as violence, since this is your Appalachian fantasy. So talk about the piece a little bit.
Sure, yeah. It's partly, I mean, it's barely composed, and then the rest is just sort of arranged. But I call it my Appalachian fantasy, and the start of the fantasy is inspired by Schubert, mm-hmm. actually. And this fantasy, I wrote it for a CD that I've just finished making and should be released within a year or so. It's a CD of fantasies, and on that CD is included the Schubert fantasy for violin and piano. And Schubert himself steals a song of his to put into that fantasy, and he writes variations on it. So I figured if he's stealing his song, I could steal it too. And so I took the song and changed it into a more Appalachian style ballad in a way, and with little elements of my old Kentucky home as well in the introduction of Appalachian fantasy. And then I go from there into a medley of traditional fiddle tunes. The recording you have, I can't remember what tunes I use. It keeps changing every time I play it.
Oh, that's cool. That's very fun, though.
Yeah, it's fun, and I think that's the beauty of fiddle music, too. Medleys are really popular, a common thing that's done in Appalachian music. But I think in the recording, it's Cumberland Gap and Bonaparte's Retreat. And I included Bonaparte's Retreat because Aaron Copland used that tune in his Hoedown from Rodeo. So it's kind of a full circle, taking a classical melody and turning it into a folk song, and then presenting a folk song that was turned into concert music.
All due respect to Copland, New York-based composer who really got those tunes out of books. You actually have lived this music, so, you know, give it its due. Well, we wish you continued success. I know we're going to hear a lot more from you. We look forward to the recording coming out and all that kinds of stuff. A great career ahead of you. Two questions I ask for all my Cadenza guests to close out. The first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat with someone from the past who you never could, you never had a chance to, but could. When I asked that, you might get swamped with names. But when I asked that, what was the first name that popped in your head of somebody you'd love to chat with from the past?
A couple names came to mind. Neither of them were musicians, which is weird.
That's fine. I run the gamut here. So
yeah. I thought about Shakespeare for some reason, because wow. There's just not much like written about him, you know, the person. And then Einstein, for whatever reason.
Okay.
I don't know. I thought about Beethoven, but honestly, I don't know if he'd be like very easy to talk to. But it would be cool to be in the same room with him and observe him.
Yeah, that's a meeting of the minds of Shakespeare, Einstein, and throw Beethoven in the mix, though he might be the bull in the china shop type of thing at that table.
Yeah.
you never know, though. I mean, you and Einstein can play duets, actually. The final question's non-musical. Everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy. But when you have to get away from music, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do when you need a respite and you need to pull yourself away from music for just a few moments? What do you do?
Getting outside in whatever way that means has been really a great favorite pastime of mine as of late. There's a lot of traveling involved in the business, of course, so it's fun to get to know a town or a place by just going out and walking around, if that's easy to do in the town. I'm obsessed with espresso and coffee, so I love going to cafes. I know it's like that's a very hipster answer, but it's true.
It's true.
Yeah, and other than that, I live in New York City, and I guess your listeners are around here too, but there's so much going on here. It's just your mind can be blown and your life can be changed in every single night based on like stuff that's just going on here. So I enjoy going out and seeing different shows. Just a little bit ago, there was one night when I guested in a show at Rockwood Music Hall. Mark O'Connor, who we mentioned a few times, came in with his wife, Maggie O'Connor, just to listen. And then from there, we took a cab to the Blue Note and saw the Robert Glasper Trio play there. It's just the wealth of things that you can do in a single night in New York City is unreal. So I have a lot of fun just going out at night and seeing what's going on in the city.
Yeah, the opportunities are a little bit more than in Richmond, Kentucky, though I know it's close to your heart. But New York's a little bit different. Tessa Lark, thanks for taking some time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Violinist Tessa Lark, you can find out more about her at her website, Tessa, T-E-S-S-A, Lark, L-A-R-K.com. She will, along with pianist Andrew Armstrong, present a recital on Halloween at 6:30 p.m., well before witching hour, at the Baruch Performing Arts Center at Baruch College in Manhattan, 55 Lexington Avenue, the 25th Street entrance in the Engelmann Recital Hall. They will perform the Kreutzer Sonata of Beethoven, the complete Suite Italienne by Stravinsky, and the work with which we'll close. The recital is free, open to the public, but reservations are required. Go to baruch.cuny.edu/BPAC, Baruch Performing Arts Center. I'll leave you with my guest performing her Appalachian Fantasy, starting with a song of Schubert and morphing into a bluegrass improvisation. It's performed by my guest today and the work's composer, Tessa Lark. As always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.